As he has the framework of a future deal for Greenland, part of Denmark. We ask a former U.S. ambassador to Denmark what that could look like on Morning Edition from NPR News. Federal officers detained a 5-year-old boy in Minnesota. His family says he was used as bait to draw them out of their home. I'm Leila Faldin.
And I'm Amy Martinez. How are tactics from ICE hurting children's mental health in the Twin Cities? Also, Rahm Emanuel looks at ICE's operations and does not see the country that protected his family from the Holocaust and pogroms. And how Texas is preparing for extreme cold. It's Thursday, January 22nd. On this day in 1947, KTLA hit the airwaves in Los Angeles, the first commercial TV station west of the Mississippi. News is next.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Korva Coleman. President Trump and officials from several nations have signed the charter of Trump's Board of Peace today. Trump unveiled the document at the World Economic Forum in Davos, Switzerland. But Britain's Foreign Secretary, Yvette Cooper, says her country is not signing on. Willem Marks reports.
Cooper told BBC News that Britain would not be, quote, one of the signatories. This is about a legal treaty that raises much broader issues, Cooper said, before expressing concerns that Trump had invited Russian President Vladimir Putin to be, quote, part of something which is talking about peace. The board was initially designated as a mechanism to oversee the second phase of the US-brokered Gaza ceasefire, as well as reconstruction efforts inside the Palestinian territory. But recent details indicate it would be more of a standing global body, chaired by Trump, with France's Emmanuel Macron warning it could replace the United Nations and German officials also voicing caution about the idea. For NPR News, I'm Willem Marx in Davos, Switzerland.
Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky says he will meet this hour with President Trump in Switzerland. NPR's Joanna Kakissis reports.
Zelensky told reporters earlier this week that a meeting in Davos with Trump was contingent on progress in the U.S. brokered peace plan. Zelensky said the whole country, the whole world is waiting to see if there's a chance to end this war. Trump envoy Steve Witkoff told the panel that the plan is in its final stages, though Moscow must still approve it. It's not clear yet if Trump and Zelensky will make public remarks together. Zelensky is scheduled to give a talk in Davos and take part in a panel discussion about Ukraine's recovery. Joanna Kakissis, NPR News. Cave.
European leaders are holding a summit today to talk about transatlantic relations. This comes after President Trump said yesterday he would not use military force to annex Greenland. The island is controlled by Denmark, a NATO ally. Trump says he's got a framework for a future Greenland deal. The House Oversight Committee has approved a resolution to hold former President Bill Clinton and former Secretary of State Hillary Clinton in contempt of Congress. The matter now moves to the full House. NPR's Claudia Grisales reports the bipartisan rebuke comes after the couple defied a congressional subpoena tied to Jeffrey Epstein.
House Oversight Committee Republicans said the panel gave the Clintons plenty of time to testify, but some Democrats argued GOP members were rushing to judgment. Democrats were nearly evenly split on the panel, with a majority, 9-all, joining Republicans to hold former President Clinton in contempt. 8 Democrats voted no, but only 3 Democrats joined Republicans in a vote to do the same for former Secretary of State Hillary Clinton. Most Democrats argued she was not privy to the same access to Epstein. The Clintons said they've turned over the, quote, little information they have. Claudia Grisales, NPR News.
You're listening to NPR News from Washington. A jury in Texas has acquitted a former Uvalde school police officer in connection with the deadly mass shooting in 2022. Adrian Gonzalez was accused of failing to do his duty when a gunman killed 21 people, mostly children. A group of artists, unions, and industry groups is launching a campaign today. It's calling for ethical AI development. NPR's Chloe Veltman reports so far the petition has garnered around 800 supporters.
The Human Artistry Campaign is a global initiative for the advancement of responsible AI. The group says its aim is to, quote, protest big tech's illegal mass harvesting of copyrighted works to build and power their generative AI platforms. Singer-songwriter Tift Merritt is a signatory.
Training on my copywritten human spirit made life's work in order to replace me with AI music to streamline profits is not innovation. It's stealing.
The campaign calls for robust copyright enforcement and licensing. Some music labels, including Warner and Universal, have already struck licensing deals with AI companies. Chloe Veltman, NPR News.
The National Weather Service says an Arctic blast of cold is pummeling the northern plains today. There are forecasts of wind chills of 50 degrees below zero. The frigid cold will combine to create a major winter storm. That will start hitting the southern plains and parts of the south by tomorrow. Areas in the south could see crippling ice. That will happen with freezing rain and sleet that spreads widely across the region. This is NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include the Lemelson Foundation, working to harness the power of invention and innovation to accelerate climate action and improve lives around the world. Learn more at lemelson.org. This is NPR.
It's where we pull up a chair to one of our members' kitchen tables. We get to know them a little bit better.
Good morning.
So, why do you listen to KBXE?
Because it is the best radio station I have ever found. I don't remember when I started listening to it, probably 20 years ago. And you have science, phenology, which I love. You are kind people. You respect everyone. You are always on the side of those who need help. I just wish I could clone you and take you all over the world. I've been wanting to say this for years, and I tell everybody I know to tune in. You know, you're the kind of people that make the world a good place. Friends, coming back in style.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. Amy Martinez in Culver City, California.
And I'm Leila Fadel in Washington, D.C. Good morning. European leaders meet in Brussels tonight for a summit that was called urgently as a reaction to President Trump's previous statements about possible military action to take Greenland, the semi-autonomous Danish territory.
Trump also had said he would impose new tariffs on countries that opposed him. But then the president spoke Wednesday in Davos.
We probably won't get anything unless I decide to use excessive strength and force, where we would be, frankly, unstoppable. But I won't do that.
He ruled out military force in an otherwise threatening speech. And on Wednesday, he said that a long-term agreement on Greenland had been reached and that it would be good for everybody. In a few moments, we'll discuss this with a former U.S. ambassador to Denmark. But first, let's get the latest.
Terry Schultz joins us from Brussels to discuss European reaction and what happens next. Good morning, Terry.
Hi, Leila.
Okay, so do we know any details of this long-term agreement?
We really don't know the details yet, and I've been scanning Danish media this morning, and there are a lot of questions being raised there. It's just been hours since we got word that there'd been a compromise at all after this fiery speech by President Trump at the World Economic Forum in Davos, Switzerland, and he hadn't indicated any such thing was coming. Mm. So while the details haven't been made public, there are reports in the New York Times, for example, that it could include giving the U.S. sovereignty over small pieces of Greenland territory, perhaps for building up more military bases there, possibly for participation in the eventual Golden Dome missile defense system. Now, Leila, the U.S. already has the right to expand its military presence under existing agreements with Greenland and Denmark, but the land on which these bases would sit does not belong to the U.S. under current arrangements. And ownership has been such a big issue for Trump, and he repeated that multiple times in Davos. Let's listen to one example.
All we're asking for is to get Greenland, including right title and ownership, because you need the ownership to defend it. You can't defend it on a lease.
So Trump's obvious satisfaction with the compromise indicates it could very well include some limited transfer of land ownership, and it's also expected to address U.S. access to mineral rights.
How are European leaders reacting to the developments in Davos?
Well, there's definitely the feeling of being able to breathe a bit more easily after Trump walked back these threats of military force and imminent tariffs, which have been a feature of daily discussion here in Brussels recently. Danish Foreign Minister Lars Løkke Rasmussen summed up Wednesday by saying it ended better than it started, as there'd been so much apprehension about what might happen in Davos.
Now, we've seen protests in Denmark and Greenland against Trump's ambitions. Is this new framework something their governments are likely to accept, or as much as we know about it?
Yeah, we're getting some early reactions from Danish and Greenlandic leaders now, and their comments are reinforcing the fact that the details of this deal, as we discussed, are very slim. Denmark's Prime Minister, Mette Frederiksen, has issued a statement now underscoring that things like security, investment, and economy can be discussed politically, but not sovereignty. That, quote, only Denmark and Greenland can make decisions on issues relating to Denmark and Greenland. So it's quite interesting that these talks in Davos were not led by Danes and Greenlanders, but by the NATO Secretary General Mark Rutte. Rutte is known for his constant flattery of Trump, and the two get along well. But a Greenlandic member of parliament has already written on social media that, quote, NATO in no way has a mandate to negotiate without Greenland.
That's Terry Schultz reporting in Brussels. Thank you, Terry.
You're welcome.
For more on the fallout from this week's meetings in Davos, I'm joined now by Alan Leventhal. He served as the U.S. ambassador to Denmark from 2022 to 2025. Ambassador, so he's just heard the details are thin on this new framework. What would you think an effective deal could look like?
Well, first, I have to tell you, I obviously followed this very closely. I've been doing a lot of interviews over the past week. I've been very concerned about the consequences of what would what could have happened. I had this feeling this morning that I had just been standing on top of a cliff looking over at an abyss. And I didn't know how deep that abyss was. And the idea that we would take military action against a NATO ally, the consequences for NATO, the consequences for the world trade, the EU-US trade relationship is $1.6 trillion a year. It represents more than 5 million jobs in America. I read up again on Smoot-Hawley and the impact during the Depression of President Hoover signing that tariff bill against the recommendations of thousands of economists that said it would cause a depression. So I felt a great sense of relief this morning that we had pulled back from what would have been severe consequences to the U.S., Europe, the world, NATO, Russia, China, Taiwan. All these things were spinning in my head.
Wanted to know, though, just played the president saying that you have to have ownership to defend it, can't defend it on lease. Greenland is a territory of Denmark. Denmark's a part of NATO. If indeed another nation that is not part of NATO decided to attack Greenland, why wouldn't the U.S. as part of NATO defend it? I'm wondering what you make of the president's statement.
I never understood what the difference was between ownership and lease. You know, I grew up in the real estate business. There are many long-term leases which have the rights of ownership. So I never quite understood that. What I was also struck by this morning is if, in fact, we have to wait and see what else comes out.
Right.
So I'm rushing to judgment. We're getting pieces of this. We do know that the president said he's not using force. We do know that he's pulled back from his proposed tariffs on the EU. You know, the rest of it is speculation. But my initial reaction is all the things that are being talked about, Denmark was prepared to do from the very beginning. And I've told everybody I've talked to, you know, the Danes view the U.S. as like an older brother. 90% of the Danes who emigrated from Denmark from the 1850s on went to small towns across America. This huge Danish community in the U.S. And wherever the U.S. goes to fight, Danes are side by side. Iraq, Afghanistan, they suffer. They have grievous injuries, deaths, and per capita rates equal or higher to the U.S. So there's a great love of the U.S. And the Prime Minister, Frederiksen, who I have been so impressed with during my service there, she would among the, there couldn't have been a stronger voice for the importance of the transatlantic relationship. Has always stood up for the U.S. So it's just so hard to conceive of why we were going through this. But you know,
going through it, Ambassador, in such a threatening way?
In a way that was so harmful and potentially, we're, you know, as I talked about standing at the abyss and looking over, I think the consequences of this were horrific to the relationship, to the Europe, to the U.S., not just to Denmark and Greenland. But look, I'm relieved. I'm hopeful that we can get this resolved quickly. And if it, whether it means owning, you know, areas of Greenland to put bases on, you know, longer term leases, whatever the terms are, I hope this can all be worked out quickly and we can put the, you know, this all behind us.
So
because it's important.
Yeah.
It's important to move forward.
So if indeed this gets worked out quickly, the aftermath, the relationship between Washington and Europe at this point, where do you think that stands?
Well, I think it's, you know, we can speculate about that. You know, this has been, I've read the comments from the European leaders this morning and, you know, the damage that has been done. But, you know, I know Denmark better than I know the other European countries. There's such a strong foundation in the relationship between the people of Denmark and the people of the U.S. I'm confident, you know, if once we get through this, we'll move forward in a positive way. I was very interested that when all this was taking place, you know, we had the events in Venezuela following the appointment of a special envoy, Governor Landry of Louisiana, to Greenland, and there were polls being taken, and 75-80% of Americans opposed military action in Greenland. Americans get it. They understand, you know, what Europe means, what Denmark means, the strong relationship, and they understand the difference between that and a brutal, you know, drug-running dictatorship who gets in bed with our adversaries. And that's the thing that just really stuck with me, that that American people understand this is Denmark. This is, you know, this is a NATO ally, a founding member of NATO. You know, Europe is important to the U.S. Our trade relationship is important. NATO's important, gets strong support. So I just feel that cooler heads have prevailed. And we will be in a better place.
But Ambassador, I wanted to get one more. Right, we only have about a minute left, Ambassador. I wanted to ask you this question. I think it's important. If indeed President Trump gets what he wants by at first issuing threats, then what's the world to make of a next time he makes threats over something else that he might want?
I don't want to speculate on that, and I don't think it's even meaningful to speculate on that. I think we just need to get this resolved and move on. But what strikes me is we could have done this so quickly with Denmark and Greenland because Denmark is such a close friend of the U.S. I feel better today, I hope, before the day, to the end of the day or very quickly. We'll know the details of this. And we'll have the ability to move on.
Okay.
The Danes will continue to be great friends to America. This relationship is enduring. I know the Danes will get beyond all of it.
That is Alan Leventhal, former U.S. Ambassador to Denmark. Ambassador, thank you. This is NPR News.
Good morning. It is 6:19 and you are tuned in to the KEXE Morning Show. I'm Heidi Holton. Coming up, we're going to be talking fishing. Yes, fishing on a frigid day like today with our early bird fishing guide, Jeff Sundin. Here is what we're seeing. Extreme cold warning and watch. And that is from today. And it's expected to be throughout the weekend, even into Monday. with wind chill from 40 to 55 below zero. The dangerously cold wind chills could cause frostbite on exposed skin in as little as 5 minutes. For today, we're expecting and seeing right now a slight chance of snow and flurries, partly sunny and cold, temperatures 4 below to 10 below, falling throughout the day, blustery northwest winds 10 to 30. Tonight, partly cloudy, chance of flurries 27 below to 31 below around the region, with northwest winds from 10 to 25. And tomorrow, Friday, mostly sunny and cold, daytime highs 11 to 16 below zero, evening lows 27 to 34 below zero. And by Saturday, highs 4 below to 7 below, with evening lows from 16 to 28 below zero. Now, our question of the week, we knew it would be cold this week. It generally is what are your favorite ways to spend time outside during the winter? My question to you would be, will you be doing that in the frigid cold? Do you have all the proper gear so that you can stay warm? We want to hear your thoughts on winter and how to stay outside or how to do some things outside. You can text 218-326-1234. Maybe it's in a wheelhouse with warmth, but fishing out there. If you have a question or want to weigh in on ice fishing, love to hear from you this morning during our conversation with Jeff Sundin. You can text 218-326-1234. Some cancellations around our region. If you have something that was planned and need to let us know about it, feel free to text us at 218-326-1234.
Gone fishing. There's a sign upon your door.
Pops, don't blab it around, will you?
Gone fishing.
Keep it shady. I got me a big one staked out.
You ain't working anymore.
I don't have to work. I got me a piece of Gary.
Cows need milking in the barn.
I have the twins on that detail. Each take a side.
But you just don't give a darn.
Give them 4 bits of cow and hand lotion.
You just never seem to learn.
Man, you taught me.
You ain't got no ambition.
You're convincing me.
Gone fishing. Got your hound dog by your side.
That's old Cindy Lou going with me.
Gone fishing. Fleas are biting at his hide.
Get away from me, boys. You're bothering me. Folks won't find us now because Mr. Satch and Mr. Cross, we gone fishing. Instead of just a wishing,
bop 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 bop.
Oh yeah.
Time to talk fishing on the Thursday morning show. Here is Jeff Sundin, our early bird fishing guide. Warm, I hope.
Well, that's a debatable question. I'm in my cubby hole. Sitting working on the computer. It seems like the wind and the cold air just sort of finds me in the lower portions of our house, no matter what happens. So I'm warm enough.
I know.
How's that?
It's something. Well, let's start off. You know, the weather, of course, has been the big news, but that doesn't mean people aren't doing stuff. And they're ice fishing, some of them looking for places to, you know, bring their fish houses, their big ice castles and things like that. How do you go about figuring out where to go? You don't just randomly drive out on a lake.
Well, that's the interesting thing. And coincidentally, a friend of mine sent me a text just a couple days ago wondering where her brother could put his fish house that he just acquired. And that, you know, the first question is, okay, so how big of a fish house are we talking about? Because these days, the wheelhouses, as nice as they are for comfort, you get them nice and warm and you got comfortable places to sit and everything is lit brightly and so on and so forth. But they do cost you something in terms of efficiency when it comes to, you know, finding a good place to put them. You get to be sort of a slave to wherever there's, first of all, even the smallest size ones, even a modest size single axle one, you have to be able to either drive it out there with a good size ATV, like one of the larger side-by-sides, or you have to be able to pull it with a vehicle. So you either have to have no snow on the ice and no slush, so on and so forth, or you have to have some rental operator or a resort that offers a plowed road. And that most folks wind up going with the plowed road option just because it's a way to get on a lake. But then you still have the trouble of where are you going to, once you get out there, you're on the lake, where am I going to set the thing down? So some of these operators will plow a spot for you. Some of them you're just kind of on your own, you know, find yourself a place where it looks like you can pull it off of their road to start drilling holes. The one thing that if it was just a total easy drop it here and you're always going to catch fish, that spot is going to get consumed by people really fast. And what seems to happen in the wintertime is the most popular, and you know, a place will start off being very, very productive, and it'll stay that way for a little while, but then just traffic, people coming and going. So I recommend, if possible at all, is to use the wheelhouse as a kind of a headquarters. Get nearby a place, but still within reach of some structure that you can walk to, or take a four-wheeler or something like that. Or probably in some cases, folks can even, you know, disconnect from the fish house and drive a little bit further to find some of the more private spots. We actually did a video on this about, it's probably 15 or 20 years ago. I'll see if I can look that up and maybe, but we took the plowed road that the resort offered and then compare our location. Almost everybody has got some access to a GPS chart now. So as you move along the plowed road, you can see different areas where there might be a bar or a deep water hole, a shallow mud flat, some kind of structure, and places where that road gets nearby a structure that looks interesting, park there, and then either hoof it over to the structure or get there on a snowmobile or something like that. And that's probably the most efficient way to do it, the most effective. That, unfortunately, other than doing a little bit of checking ahead of time, talking to resorts and kind of get a feel for, number one, how much traffic do they actually serve? In my opinion, somebody that has a road plowed out on a lake that maybe has 100 fish houses on it versus someone else that has a road that's serving 2,500 fish houses, I would go with the smaller of the two operations. Number one, there's just less commotion on the ice. And number two, you got a lot better chance that whoever that operator is going to be able to share a little bit of information with you, what's going on out on the lake, you know, maybe some tips about the lures and the species of fish that are biting and that type of thing. So that's my starting spot. And then short of just, you know, passing out GPS coordinates, that's about as close as you can get when you're fishing with wheelhouses. They're very comfortable. It's sort of a lifestyle fishing experience rather than the efficiency. The best way, if you just want to catch fish and there's no other consideration, it's still almost impossible to beat a snowmobile with a pull-behind shelter, and you get to your spot, flip that shelter over, drill a couple of holes, try it. If you don't like it, you can move again in just, you know, 5 minutes. And that's about as close as you can get to having a boat. And some of our experiences with wheelhouses, that's how we've done it. We bring the snowmobiles and the portables. We use the shelter for lodging overnight to sleep and to stay comfortable during the day, kind of a warming house and a place to get some warm food and so on. So that's let's start with that, and then maybe there'll be some questions we can drill into a little bit further. One last thing about that it came to my mind when I was getting ready for this morning. Lots of folks you'll see driving up and down the highway have taken to buying large pickup trucks and putting snow plows on them and creating their own, you know, when they get to the lake, they're creating their own road or their own slip. There's no law that says you can't do that. just be really careful about where you drop that plow, and because you can very quickly ruin a network of roads that some operator has spent the entire winter trying to get that established and slush free and so on and so forth. And you drill one slip in the wrong spot and start drilling holes, you can create all kinds of havoc, and it affects many, many people, not just where you want to park your house for the day. So do it if you want to, but be extremely cautious about where you do it, and you'll make a lot more friends that way than you will if you just start plowing roads willy-nilly.
Right. You're not the only one out there. Thank you. Well, let's look back a little bit. Last weekend was the trout opener. What did you hear, and what are some suggestions?
Well, it was good. It was kind of up in the Ely area, especially the folks at Arrowhead Outdoors shared some reports with me, and they had really a good opener. Lots of folks were catching their limits. Now, one thing that they did say is that if you wanted to get out there and catch the stream trout, lake trout are a little more tolerant to sunshine and open water and midday fishing, but the stream trout can be a little bit early and late in the day is better for them. And a lot of folks that were catching brook trout and rainbow trout were catching them before they had their limits, before 8 o'clock in the morning on the opener. Now that's not typical, but on a lot of the lakes that we fish, there's the trout are stocked into the lake, and the purpose for stocking them in is to be utilized. So as those fish are put in, we have the trout opener comes along, people come to the lake, drill some holes, catch the fish. The population of fish doesn't stay stable throughout the entire winter. So as you go, that getting out there early in the morning and getting them while they're active, that becomes more important as you go through the winter. But generally speaking, there's enough to keep folks interested throughout most of the winter. And some ideas about where to go, it will amaze you. Last week, when I talked to Carrie, I promised I would put up in the report a link to the map that shows where all of the trout waters are. And you can find this on the DNR website as well, but I just made it a little bit easier by putting it out right up in front where people can find it quickly. So if you want to drop onto the website, you can find that map. And there's two ways of doing it. One is to just call the map up and then see where the lakes are, and then you can click on them. Or you can also, on that same page on the DNR website, they'll give it to you in the form of a list, county by county. So you can just scroll down the list and look for the name of the lake, and maybe it's a place that you've heard of before, so on and so forth. If you don't want to make a big expedition out of it and travel up into the northeast region, or if you don't want to cross the border into Canada, you want to just stay close to home, this map is a really good way to do it, because it illustrates places where the DNR has been putting those fish in. And like I said, the entire purpose of putting those fish into a lot of these lakes is for folks to be able to utilize them. So within a reasonable driving distance of most people, there are a lake or two. You know, we've got some around Grand Rapids. There's some by Bemidji, some down at Hill City. It's not hard to find a place to go try it, and they can be a little busy sometimes. You don't want to be the last one to get to the landing, but you can usually find a place to go.
All right. Well, big news and announcements were all across media about walleye limits. You know, it's not, there's a lot going on. A lot of people are offering their opinions, and, you know, we're quite a ways into the process of it. Can you comment and help us understand what's happening?
Yeah, Heidi, I'm scratching my head, because it seems like you do your best. We've been talking about this for a long time. In fact, I looked it up. This has been going on for 18 years. So there's been a lot of comments going back and forth. And I feel bad for people, because once the DNR made its official announcement last week than every one of the major fishing organizations. They've all posted that on their social media pages. And I have felt bad for anglers who are still providing comments, but there's nothing, there's really nothing left to do. The only choice that we have to make right now is yes or no. So the public comment period that's underway at the moment, and even this is, they're going to make you work for it a little bit. There is no survey. There is no link to just click on and express what your thoughts are. If you want to tell the DNR, if you're in favor of dropping the limit from 6 walleyes in possession down to 4, then you can say, yep, I'm in favor of that. And if you would rather have some other alternative and you're opposed to that, you can say, no, those are your two choices, up, thumbs up, thumbs down. And one of the comments kind of got my brain working again. About 4 years ago, I had published a list of the 14 Midwestern states where walleye fishing is kind of the most likely to be a thing. Now, there's other lakes state or nationwide where you can catch walleyes, but these are the states that walleyes are kind of the biggest deal. Of those 14 states, at the time, Minnesota already had the most restrictive possession for walleyes out of the 14 states. And I got the idea that I'd better go revise that and update that chart. So I did it, and I have it available. It'll be on this morning in the report. And even before we lower this limit, Minnesota still enjoys the position of being the most restrictive walleye state in terms of possession limit. So what we're talking about doing is make it even the most restrictive state out of the 14. So instead of 6 fish, we'll be allowed to have 4. That's the important distinction. It's the possession limit will be 4, not the daily limit. There is no difference between the two. So A, the limit is 4 fish, yes or no. Those are your two choices. You have to either email the DNR to let them know, call them on the telephone, or there may be one other alternative. But oh yes, you can use a U.S. mail. You can drop a letter in the mailbox and send it to them that way. So those are your three choices, and that's all available on the website already. So if you want to look that up quick and just find a link to the addresses or the email, you can do that. And I've heard already from a couple of folks that have responded and sent their comments in. So that's where we're at. You've got till March 31st, and at that stage of the game, it will possibly be done. I think it will be done. We'll find out soon enough. We'll keep you posted as we go.
All right. You are headed to Brainerd today. What are you going to be doing there? What are you thinking about?
Today's meeting is the Minnesota DNR's technology work group meeting. So the hot topic that came out of the roundtable a couple weeks ago, fair chase and angler ethics, are going to be on the tip of everybody's mind. And it's been dawning on me. I've been watching. We've had all these meetings, and I've seen a lot of charts now. And I'm looking at one right now, which I think is extremely interesting. It came out of the Winnie work group, and the scoping survey that measured angler preferences, folks they seem to be accepting of lower limits, but they still want to catch more fish. So in other words, I don't necessarily need to put them all in my live well, but I want to catch more. And a really healthy percentage of people want to catch more, and they also want to catch larger fish. So their expectations are that going forward, somehow or another, we're going to improve fishing. And the key thing here is being driven by kind of the higher end anglers who really know how to catch fish. They're the ones that point to a lot of this technology. And what a lot of these guys are doing is capitalizing on their ability and their the available technology, and they're saying we want to shape all of fishing to suit us, and then the rest of you, you just fall in line, you just do whatever we say, and this will be best. So I have a big idea. I probably maybe will get the crossways look, but from a couple of people. But I think that when it comes right down to it, we already know we can't legislate ethics or proper behavior, but we can do what we can do to encourage that. I'm going to suggest today that DNR fisheries staff throughout the state who are approached to issue permits for fishing tournaments, before you would issue a permit for a tournament, is that the tournament director establishes a board of ethics who takes into consideration the best ethical practices. Don't fish in deep water, don't target this, don't do that, you know, how to release the fish, so on and so forth. And then this fishing ethics board would have to convince the fishery staff that they have taken these things into consideration before a permit can get issued, because there's a lot of fishing tournaments in Minnesota, and this is where this technology is driving the driver. People do what they see these elite anglers doing. If I see you out there using forward sonar, or we talked last week about this Omni sonar, which is even more has even more capability than the forward sonar. When I see folks using that, it makes me feel like I need to have it too. And so if we're going to promote the technology, we should also be promoting the ethical use of it. And that's kind of where I'll have an interesting comment, I'm sure, next week. We'll see how that's received by the group today when I'm down there, and see if that looks like it's got any kind of potential going forward. But I don't think you're not going to be able to grab all this technology and stuff it back into a box. We're just going to keep getting more of it and more of it. So we're going to have to tackle the people part of it, where we just go out and, you know, we do our best to be decent, how we do things and why we do them and where we do them, and try to influence each other that way.
Reminding us of decency, that's pretty regular for you, Jeff. I appreciate that. Next week, we'll also, the ice fishing season and winter conditions, it seems hard to believe at this moment as we have all these weather advisories, but things will change. And so we will start to think about that next week, right?
Yeah, let's get off the subject of all these meetings and everything and just talk about fishing for a little while.
All right, so that sounds good.
We'll make that next week. We'll talk about how to plan for some of these changing conditions coming up.
All right. Sounds great. Thanks, Jeff.
You bet. Thank you. See ya.
See ya. Jeff Sundin, you can read more, find out about some of the maps that he mentioned at his website. It is jeffsundin.com. Coming up next, it is National Native News. We're learning about a Navajo girl who'd gone missing in the community of Coal Mine near Tuba City, Arizona. Stay tuned for that story.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. Malika Molly Boone, a Navajo girl who'd gone missing in the community of Coal Mine near Tuba City, Arizona, marks the second time an alert system has been used in search of a Native American since its implementation last year. As KJZZ's Gabriel Pietrazio reports, that search is now over.
The FBI Phoenix Field Office confirmed that Boone's body was found on Friday following a multi-agency search that included law enforcement authorities from the Arizona DPS, U.S. Marshals Service, Coconino County Sheriff's Office, and Flagstaff Police Department.
To learn that this search has ended in loss is a pain beyond words.
Navajo Nation President Boo Nigrin took to social media to share his condolences, not just for Malika, but also 3-year-old Carson Apodaca.
In just the past few weeks, with the tragedy in Kienta and now this heartbreaking news from Coal Mine, our nation has endured tremendous pain. These moments remind us just how sacred our children are and how deeply connected every life is within our Navajo community. May we honor Malika's spirit by cherishing and protecting every child across the Navajo Nation.
The investigation into Malika's death is being handled by the FBI and Navajo Department of Criminal Investigations. For National Native News, I'm Gabriel Pietrazio.
On the opening day of the New Mexico legislative session Tuesday, a protest was held at the state capitol in Santa Fe. KUNM's Jeanette Didio spoke to indigenous people at the event.
Hundreds of New Mexicans rallied and marched up the steps towards the roundhouse. Oglala Sioux Nation member John Swiftbird led the march with other Native drummers.
The energy always gets to the people. People have always resonated to the singing and to the energy of it.
He's been advocating back and forth between New Mexico and South Dakota ever since the 2016 protest in Standing Rock against the Dakota Access Pipeline. Longtime activist elder Kathy Sanchez from San Ildefonso Pueblo gave a blessing and told attendees to not give up.
Everything that is brought forth in a good way will survive because all of us are not giving up on each other.
CSN Hope from the Mescalero Apache and Diné Nations is an advocate for the Southwest Solidarity Network and Revolutionary Two-Spirit Collective. Hope is advocating for land and water protections and says it's important for Indigenous people to understand and exercise their rights.
The only reason that we have them is because people before us, our ancestors before us, have fought for us to be here, have fought for us to have the right to, you know, live.
She wants lawmakers and the governor to continue upholding tribal consultation on Native issues and says she and other advocates will continue to fight for tribal rights. I'm Jeanette Didios.
The founder of a missing and murdered Indigenous people organization is sharing the faces of those affected by the crisis. KLCC's Brian Bull reports on a new exhibit in Salem, Oregon.
Amanda Freeman founded Umpqua Advocacy and has displayed nearly three dozen photos of Native people who've lost a relative or have suffered domestic violence or addiction. It's titled Umpqua Munkshlush Insaika Shawash Dilakum, which means healing our Indigenous relatives. Red handprints and a long red trailing dress adorn the walls and wrap around each portrait. Freeman says she wants visitors to leave with one impression.
I would like them to remember that we're not disposable. I would like them to leave with the mindset of, let me share this information because I had no idea. Because any awareness is good awareness.
A reception and artist talk will be held January 28th. The exhibit runs through February 6th at the Gretchen Schutte Art Gallery at Chemeketa Community College. For National Native News, I'm Brian Bull.
And I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
National Native News is produced.
National Native News is produced by Quantic Broadcast Corporation, a public media entity that we rely on for alternative news and things you may not get anywhere else. I'm Heidi Holton with Kari Headland. Up next, we're going to be hearing from last night's broadcast of All Things Considered. We've got a story coming out of Minnesota, and we'll continue to rely on Morning Edition and All Things Considered. They are covering the international story that is the state of Minnesota right now. So stay tuned for that. Morning, Kari.
Good morning.
Well, I'm assuming that you did not walk into work today.
No walking for me this morning. Although it is actually...
Okay, we'll get to you in just a second, Kari. How's that? Coming up next, we'll hear this story of a 12-year-old immigrant in Minneapolis, broadcast last night on All Things Considered.
Criminals off the street. Some people in the city have told NPR it's created a sense of terror. NPR's Jasmine Garz brings us the story of one 12-year-old girl who desperately needed to run one errand and how it turned into a complex underground operation.
On the morning of January 17th in southern Minneapolis, something very ordinary happened. A 12-year-old girl got her period for the first time. Everything that happened after that was out of the ordinary. We're calling this girl E, her first initial. Her family asked for this because they're undocumented and their neighborhood has been the target of immigration raids. In fact, everyone in this story requested anonymity out of fear of retaliation from ICE. E woke up that morning. She'd noticed she had her period. Like many girls, she freaked out a little. But unlike many girls, Yi had been hiding in her house for the last few weeks. She hadn't even been going to school. She thought about going to get menstrual pads. She called her dad at work. He's a single father. He told her no. Do not go out into the streets, he told her. You have to stay inside. He himself isn't going outside unless a volunteer is driving him. He feels it makes him less likely to be stopped by ICE agents. He's not the only one. A lot of immigrants are relying on their neighbors to drive them around the city. So her dad couldn't just rush back home. This launched a community effort involving a complex network of local volunteers. First, the dad called his pastor. The pastor called a church community leader, a woman. Her name is Lisette. She says Yi's dad was scared. He said to me, Lisette, help me, please. My daughter is bleeding a lot. She's alone in the house. Lisette reassured him, told him to stay calm.
Si hubiera estado un tiempo normal, solamente le hubiera dicho, okay.
But she herself was too nervous to go out into the streets. So Lisette called a neighbor, whose name is Aide. Here she is.
Quiero pedirle un favor. Está asustada.
Over the phone, Lisette told her, I need a favor. There's a girl. She's scared. She's crying. She doesn't know what to do. Aide paused. She wanted to help. Any other time, she says she would have gone out and done it. But since the killing of Renee Macklin Good by an ICE agent, she's been trying to stay inside. So she called her daughter. Enter Fanny. Fanny is a U.S. citizen, but she too worries about driving around and being racially profiled.
Even if you're like a citizen, just because I am Hispanic, they're still going to want to take me.
Immigrants we spoke to in Minneapolis say they've been making this calculation for weeks, whether or not it's safe to go out. And often, they decide it's not. In response, there's been massive community mobilization. On a lot of street corners, you'll see neighbors standing guard. They're looking out for agents so they can alert their neighbors. We spoke to one watcher who asked to be called by her initials, JB. JB is 69 years old. She was standing in the blustering wind.
I don't care if it's 20 below. I don't care. We'll dress for it. We'll be here. This is way more important than a little chill air.
Aide and Fanny say the street watchers make them feel safer. So they decided to do it, to drive to Yi's house with some pads.
Bueno, cuando llegué, le hablé que ya estaba ahí, que estaba por la parte de atrás.
Aide says they parked in the back alley. It felt too risky to park out front. Yi let them in through the back door. And that's how, several hours later, five people in a citywide network of volunteers got a 12-year-old girl her first menstrual pad. Here's Yi the next day talking to a nurse.
How are you feeling?
My tummy hurts, she told the nurse. This is an underground clinic for immigrants who are too scared to go to the doctor. The nurse comforted her.
It's normal. It's really normal, okay? It can be, like, really scary when you get your period for the first time, but it's very normal.
Yi doesn't speak fluent English yet, but Lisette, the community leader who coordinated the whole operation, was there. She told her, this is going to happen to you once a month. And then she reminded her, you have an army of women behind you. She told Yi, we are made of a strong material. Even if we are drowning, we will find a way to stay afloat and get to the shore. Jasmine Garst, NPR News, Minneapolis.
And earlier today, Yi was relocated to what her pastor describes as a safe house due to an increase in ICE activity in her neighborhood.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Corva Coleman. President Trump and officials from several nations have...
National Public Radio's Morning Edition here on People Powered, KAXE. I'm Heidi Holton with Kari Headland.
Good morning.
Good morning. Let's take a look. We've got, of course, weather is the big story. And I just want to take a look at the temperatures right now with you know, hearing about wind chills from 40 to 55 below zero. Right now, 8 below in Grand Rapids and 10 below in Hibbing. Bemidji reporting 13 below with mist. That doesn't sound fun.
How is it even misting?
I know.
At this?
1 below in Brainerd. You know, I was yesterday was recording the sound of the squeaking snow to use on Season Watch that you'll hear. And it was also kind of snowing. It wasn't quite grapple, which Latimer talks about as like a weird mix of snow and rain and ice that happens. But it was making noise. What was coming down was making
like
noise.
The ting, 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 ting.
Yeah, not like huge hail. Like when you looked, it wasn't like, oh, a ice pile up, you know, but it was noisy, which was sort of strange.
I had a roommate in college who the sound of stepping on snow was like, she had to like run through snow because she couldn't, it hurt her ears so much to step to crunch snow leaves as well. She was also really against walking on leaves.
I have a lot of issues with not those things, but I can understand it because my ears and my listening tools, that really affects me. Like if I'm sick, I feel it in my ears. Like when things are too loud, it's horrible. I can't take it. And one of the things I can't stand in the winter, it's not the walking on snow. I don't want to get that in my psyche because I might take it on. It is, I was shoveling a little bit this weekend and my husband was like, you could use the chipper on that part, like the thing to go down. And I was like, no, like I can't even handle it when I hear him chipping outside, let alone just because the sound
of it.
Yeah. The big, you know, because it's like trying to get it was like going around the house part where we hadn't shoveled. And so it's iced over and a little dangerous. And I was like, I can't. I mean, I felt like a kind of a jerk, but I just honestly I can't. I have to cover my ears in the house when I hear him doing it.
So I understand that one, but for me using a chipper, I love it because it's so satisfying, the end result, but sometimes the impact hurts my jaws.
Mm-hmm.
Like using the impact of a chipper.
Yeah, we're both pointing at
it. Yeah, I know, at the teeth. So I do understand that audible discomfort.
Yeah.
How do you feel about a blower?
I don't love it.
Yeah.
But you know, if I ever, we do use it sometimes, and you know, if you get the ear protection on, you're usually okay. You're in your own little world. We had a conversation last night that you may know, you're a little more fashion forward than I am.
Mm.
Or I don't know if this is fashion. Earmuffs. Discuss.
I think they're pointless.
Yeah. I mean, it's not, it was a crossword puzzle.
Okay.
It was a clue or something the answer was earmuffs. And we're like, who even uses earmuffs? Like we had this whole discussion.
And even my 8-year-old recently got rid of a pair of earmuffs she had because she even said, they don't actually keep my head warm. And I was like, thank you.
Got plastic or, you know, you old days was like metal on top of your head. And like, you know, I don't know. And they're not even... Fashion's not the right word. It's not like they're really cute. You sometimes
can use them for that way, I think. But
yeah, in you know, couture, sometimes see it as the adornment of all of the models or something. But I just, it made me laugh so hard. I was like, earmuffs. I would never buy earmuffs.
To me, that's something that's like, if someone is actually using something for a practical purpose to be outside, that is not it.
No. We suggest, I kind of looked at what the National Weather Service said.
Yeah, I saw some of those.
In this time that we're living in. and that includes dressing in layers. We know that. Probably not earmuffs. Face masks. Gloves. I have the whole
baklava? No, that's
what we
not
keep
it.
Calling it. It's not I wish. I have that wiped all over my head. Yes. Well, honey,
wouldn't mind that, you know.
Yeah, balaclava, something like that. A complete package thing.
What is it called, things. Heidi? That is.
Well, that's what it is, but I don't know how to say it. And then here's the deal. Check on people. It's really cold right now. People may need help getting food, staying connected, making sure they're warm, you know, all of that kind of stuff. Some people may be be very careful about using portable heaters right now.
Mm.
Inside because it is also extremely dry. And there's just a lot of things to be thinking about, and I added my own little editorial comment on that one. Do you see that?
And be kind. Yes.
I feel like it's a easy time to, like, we have our shoulders up, we're cold, kind of our brows down because it's so cold, you know?
Yeah.
And it's easy to just get stuck in your own little earmuffed world, right?
if you're wearing those.
Yes.
Yes. So. Well, we've got a morning show ahead of, we've got Best Wishes next hour. Got a special couple people on that list so far. So if you have best wishes, you can send those in